netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Well, we've had just a great reaction to the series of four Tech Behind the Films podcasts we've done with Dean Egg, ILM, Ken Ralston at Sony Picture Imageworks, and now we're going to finish that series off with Weta, with Mark Sagar, Special Project Supervisor at Weta. And this was recorded by Mike Seymour right before the SciTech Oscars, which Mark won for his work with facial retargeting. Mark specializes in facial motion capture, animation, and rendering technologies. At Weta Digital, he directed the development of the performance-driven facial animation system for Avatar and King Kong, and is currently focusing on biomechanical simulation of the face. This is going to be a good one for you who really like to get into some of the technology here. Mark's a former postdoctoral fellow at MIT. He's got a PhD in engineering from the University of Auckland, where he worked on virtual reality surgical simulation and anatomic modeling. If you remember the SIGGRAPH over the years, the electronic theater, in 2001, you remember a piece at this electronic theater called Young at Heart. Pactano Mirage at the time, Life Effects, had done this whole bunch of work with the human face back then. So he's been doing this for quite a while. Also, the Jester and the Turing Test at other SIGGRAPH electronic theaters. So you may remember that. He also spent time at Sony Imageworks and now at Weta. So, rather than me talking anymore, I just want to give you a little background on Mark. Let's jump into the interview with Mike Seymour talking to Mark.
Well, Mark, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, pleasure.
So we're going to talk in a second, hopefully, about the SciTech Award, the Scientific and Engineering Academy Award, to do with facial animation or other facial motion retargeting solutions. But I wondered if I could start by going through some of your background, some of your history, and how you got to where you were. Where did you study?
I studied at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and I started doing a physics and maths degree, the bachelor's in that, and then wasn't sure what to do after that, so went travelling for a few years, and then came back and started a PhD in engineering, and that was in a sort of crossover between engineering science and mechanical engineering. And that was with Peter Hunter, and who was working on computational physiology. And his brother Ian was making a teleoperated eye surgery robot. So I sort of was very interested in what they were doing there, and I was interested in the possibility of modeling basic organic forms on the computer, and which had mechanical realism as well as graphical realism.
But this is like around, what, 94, 95? So that's, I mean, today that would be still very impressive research. Back then it must have been really cutting edge.
It was amazing. Ian Hunter had, you know, an incredibly sort of broad view of what he wanted to do. He was trying to combine all kinds of different systems so that the robot, you know, would be teleoperated. It would also scale down the surgeon's motion, and you know, would require force feedback and also a virtual training environment. And the idea was that, you know, by building the whole thing holistically, it would be the best overall approach. And we ended up doing a SIGGRAPH paper, I think, on that in 1994. And but it was fantastic just being able to combine, you know, computer graphics, robotics, virtual reality, and, you know, applied to a medical application, and also looking at a physiologically based model of the eye. So it was really neat stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting that you were publishing at SIGGRAPH even back then, because, of course, SIGGRAPH will feature strongly in your career. You've been a great contributor to SIGGRAPH, and obviously some of your projects, which we'll come to in a second, you know, sparked an enormous sort of buzz, especially at the Electronic Theatre. But I wondered, how did you get from there to sort of PAC title? Because that Pacific title was your next position, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I'd been, for my PhD with Peter Hunter, I'd been doing a biological CAD system. So I was sort of designing techniques where you could make complex models of anatomy, which were essentially embedded in finite elements, so that they had a mechanical component as well. So that, and you could, I was doing everything kind of with volume, so that you could make anatomy that you could basically dissect as well. And when I was with Ian Hunter at MIT, a couple of businessmen, Ivan Gulis and Michael Rosenblatt, approached Ian to commercialize various technologies in his lab. And there was another guy working in the lab called Paul Charette, and he was working on laser speckle interferometry, but he was also, as part of that, he was doing a lot of image tracking software. And so I got together with him and said, you know, let's sort of combine your tracking with this modeling here, and see what we can make. And the businessmen were, one of them was a ex Hollywood producer, and he was kind of keen, you know, could we make digital actors? So we put it together and basically made a first sort of motion capture system, which would take these dots and then apply it to this kind of finite element mesh, which would then drive a face. And that was the sort of start of what we called the Life Effects system, and that pretty much ended up taking us to Hollywood, because some of the results that we were doing got shown there, and then Warner Brothers got interested, and we started doing some tests for The Incredible Mr. Limpet, doing a Jim Carrey face, and at that point we kind of moved to Hollywood.
Now, at this point in the technology, if I'm right, you've basically got a set of points on a face, and those map directly, almost one-to-one, as it were, or with some retargeting, to the animation face. In other words, we're still very much at a surface-based approach?
Yeah, it was fundamentally the data being transferred from one face to the other is just using these surface points, and it's like a direct drive sort of thing where, and you can geometrically warp it. Like, so, for example, you know, we can take the faces and warp the space in order to make it drive a different face, and we did lots of experimenting with that, and that worked quite well for some cases, but it's not, you can't generalize it. And if you have geometry which you know, say you've got something like the eyelid raising, and that goes into the same space that maybe the skin on the brow comes down into as you frown, then those are two very different motions happening in the same area of space. So there's no easy mathematical trick to retarget that.
So this led to the Life Effects, led to the short film The Jester, which was just an absolutely pivotal point in it's one of those really exciting sort of SID graphs. It was 99, and this film really seemed to completely resonate throughout the industry. How did you come to do The Jester, and did you feel its significance as you presented it?
What had happened is, actually a couple of years before The Jester, we'd been doing these photorealistic Jim Carreys, and the only people that saw those tests were Warner Brothers. But basically we couldn't show any of the material. So, you know, I was determined that we were able to somehow show what we were working on in a public arena. And so I thought, let's make a short film which basically shows off this this technology. And so we had a young actress, Jessica Velo, perform some prose that she'd written, and we motion captured that, and then used that to basically, you know, build a model of her using the same sort of technology that we'd done to do Jim Carrey, and, you know, then submitted that to SIGGRAPH. And she was wearing a hat, because we didn't know how to do hair very well at that point. And yeah, and then we'd kind of had internal feedback, you know, during that time. Like, we'd had, you know, been definite interest within the sort of Hollywood area. Like, we had people like Dennis Muren come down and see what we were doing, and so it was quite an interesting time where there was a sort of a bit of a buzz in Hollywood internally, but there was nothing which we could show to the wider community, and that was the real motivation for that film.
Now, that was a pretty awesome SIDGRAPH. That was in the heyday of electronic theatre before they, well, let me kindly say this, retooled the electronic theatre a few years ago. But at that same, if I've got my timeline correct, at that same SIDGRAPH electronic theatre in 99, not only was The Jester shown, but also Fiat Lux. And this was going to become pretty significant because, of course, this meant that you... well, ended up, I believe, with Paul Dubovic visiting you at PacTech and actually filming you doing sort of weird facial expressions at the end of 99. He actually has video, I believe, of you pulling faces.
Oh dear, I've forgotten about that. What happened? That was I saw Fiat Lux in the electronic theatre, and I was completely blown away. That was by far the best computer generated lighting I'd ever seen. And at the time, we were working on our next SIDGRAPH piece, which was called Young at Heart, where we sort of digitally aged this. The actress in The Jester to make her 80 and appear. That was going to be for a film, Young at Heart. And the point of that was I wanted to show that we could put a digital actor in a standard sort of dramatic context and, try to fool the audience. And anyway, at the time...
And this is a full 10 years before Benjamin Button, I should point out. Yeah. This was originally a 20-year-old actress going to about 80, right?
That's right. And we kind of set it up in the way that, you wouldn't be expecting anything digital. So the camera, started off in an old lady's, sort of old actress's dressing room, and then the camera would eventually pan around and you'd see her face, but it was just like she was doing nothing. She was just kind of thinking to herself, and what we're trying to capture there was just an internal moment, but on a digital character, which the audience wasn't supposed to really notice that it was a digital character. And we're also showing off the sort of wrinkling, the way we could dynamically wrinkle the skin, so we'd be calculating how much skin would wrinkle on each frame. And anyhow, part of the process of that, one of the things which we were finding really difficult was to get the lighting right, because of course this is before subsurface scattering, and so there were no good algorithms out there to do that. And it was, we'd get it would, if we really tweaked the lights just right, it would look good from certain angles, but it was just never, it was always a struggle. And so I phoned Paul Dubovic, after seeing Fiat Lux, and I said, is there a way that we can combine your lighting techniques, with our faces? Is the way that, you can do what you're doing to light skin? And so he came down to Pacific Hotel Mirage at the time, and we showed him what we were doing, and he'd said that he'd actually been a judge on the SIDGRAPH, which had reviewed The Jester. And so he was
because you didn't know him at this stage, right?
No,
and you weren't already friends, yeah.
And then when he came down, we got on really well, and we were really discussing the ins and outs of what made it difficult to render skin, getting the pores, getting the oiliness on the different parts of the surface, the specular affections, all that stuff, and the internal scattering, the bounces, and all these things. And so he went away after that, back to his group at Berkeley, and then came up with the light stage. And
now I think this is just sort of to jump in, but I think this is really important to understand, because these days it's almost impossible to think of Paul's and the team's work there without thinking of facial capture and certainly facial performance stuff. But up till this point, Paul's known for the work he did in basically the stuff that led to The Matrix. In other words, it's photogrammetry work, it's reconstructive work, it's actually architectural work, because Fiat Lux is, a cathedral. It's lighting, but it's not in any way to do with faces. And this is the point where you two meet that starts the next decade of research.
Yeah, I suspect that Paul would have got there, started working on faces anyway at some point, but this probably accelerated it. So there was a little bit of catalytic action happening there, and it was neat being able to sort of specify a very direct thing which we wanted to achieve.
And Light Stage 1 was, for those that don't know, it was like literally bits of wood and rope. And this was not the most high-tech. I mean, it was the most high-tech, but also it was sort of very much, you know, building it because no one had ever done it before because you guys were making it up as you went along.
Yeah, I mean, Paul and his team constructed. I never actually saw the very first light.
Oh, you never got to Light Stage 1? I thought you did.
No. Paul came down and sort of showed me the results and things, and it looked fantastic. But I never actually physically saw Light Stage 1. Light Stage 2, I spent a lot of time and that for the Spider-Man 2, but and by that time Paul had moved to ICT in Marina Del Rey, so you know that was very close. But I never actually,
because of course you and Tim Hawkins and Paul, of course, and John Morris will actually end up getting the SciTech award for the design of the light stage. What that was last year, SciTech award,
yeah, that's right,
2010,
yeah. And kind of part of that was. Part of the story is that we had Paul had done the first light stage, and then the plan was to use our data for to build an animated face using the light stage, and then that kind of all got put on hold because of there was some political issues. I think I've heard Paul talk about it before, but there were some reasons that the two companies couldn't work together, and so we kind of put that on hold. And then it turned out, you know, a couple of years later, when I started at Sony Imageworks, they wanted to use the light stage again. So I had this opportunity to work with Paul again and basically implement a system for production for Spider-Man 2. And so that ended up being the first application of the light stage technology in film. So that's kind of which takes us back to the SciTech Awards. So it was this strange sort of situation of being a catalyst early on, and then later on actually going back and applying it at a very direct level. So it was neat, and it's always a pleasure working with Paul. He's a fantastically inspiring character, and he's got such a clarity of thought that there's always stuff going on.
So if we leave the lighting stuff for a second, though, I could talk to you about that all day long. Around this time, you're now at Sony, and even though the film doesn't come out for a year or two, Monster House is a really pivotal point in the development of this facial animation stuff, because in a way, I understand, that's the first time, we spoke a moment ago about a one-to-one correlation between like the first iteration of trying to performance capture a face and track that from the markers on the face to the target face. But now at Monster House, you actually go to the face's action coding system, the actual idea of having an intermediate kind of performance space. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So years ago... at MIT, I think in the mid-90s, a guy called Irfan Esser had developed a computer vision technique for trying to calculate the facts of video images. And so basically, I'll just explain what the facts are. So it's a facial action coding system, and it's like a facial alphabet. So it's a way of breaking down facial expression into groups of muscle activations. So and the neat thing about it is it's basically the most efficient way to describe the information in a face. And but anyway, the stuff that should be done at MIT wasn't really applicable to a production environment. And at PTM and Life Effects, we'd been experimenting with building faces, and especially when we got into the internet business, we started looking at what's the efficient ways to stream that data, and so we were looking at you know, PCA and things like that. And it was never really very easy to edit this data. And so after I finished at LifeFX and before I started at Sony, I started, thinking, how can we efficiently represent, something editable, which can work in a, work for a face that you can break down that motion and have something editable, something understandable. And then I kind of started going back to the facts stuff, which I'd sort of become aware of at MIT. And I thought, okay, that's... Then I started experimenting around with sort of mathematical techniques to break down that data and make it usable, because, I mean, the big problem with facial motion is it's very nonlinear. And anyway, I came up with something to kind of work with that. And when I started at Sony, I sort of suggested this is a potential approach, but they'd already committed to another approach for Polar Express. And anyhow, later on, after I'd finished working on Spider-Man, the Monster House movie came up, and Damian Gordon, who's a motion capture supervisor there, who I knew well, and he's a real sort of powerhouse in motion capture, and I'd discussed this fax system with him during the year, and I was sort of telling him, how it could solve a bunch of the problems that they were having. And so he was really keen to try it out, and so we did a test for Monster House using these techniques, and it was successful. So then Jay Red, the visual effects supervisor, and they decided, okay, yeah, let's go with this technique. And the thing which was useful about it was that you had very, very stylized cartoon-like faces for the characters in Monster House, which were very different from the actors. And so there was no easy way to just take the motion of the skin of the actor and map it across to the character, because the faces are really different and they're really stylized. So the fax was perfect for that, because you could actually break down what they were doing into expressions. And then you really... all you have to do is build a corresponding expression in the stylized character, and as long as you can calculate what that expression is, you've now got a one-to-one mapping, and so you can drive any face with the expression data, and that was sort of the key thing which worked in Monster House, so that you've kind of broken the geometric connection between your motion capture data and the in the actual character.
But it's not just topology, is it? Because it's also that the idea of going into expression space as the interim step between the first and the second gives you a reduction in noise, gives you sort of the ability to art direct, gives you like a whole lot of benefits.
Yes, that's a big one, because there's always like the noise was one of the, I think, the things which Damien was had been dealing with on Polar Express, because the problem is that they had many actors in a very large volume, and so there's a lot of so there's a lot of noise in the markers, and if you apply that directly to a face, you get all kinds of swimming motion on the actual model. And so the only way to fix that is with heavy filtering, but then you kind of end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater. You're killing exactly what it is that motion capture is giving you, which is this wonderful sort of high frequency information. So really what you're doing with this system is you're saying you're breaking down, it's increasing the signal to the noise. You're really breaking down the motion capture data into its fundamental information content. And if I made an analogy with music, you've recorded a symphony, and now you are working out what notes are being used, because you want to apply that same piece of music to a completely different orchestra.
Well, let me use that music analogy for you, because it would seem to me as a bystander that if you were going from one simple or even complex expression to another as a straight, I am happy, I am now sad, then that solves a lot of problems. But what if I'm going from happy to a bit sad and a bit perplexed, and I'm therefore having to have multiple instruments in the orchestra whose notes are different.
Exactly, and that's where the fact system, the way that it solves it, is that not only does it work out what expression, and it's not like, so in the case of like happy to sad, it's not going from the happy state, it's actually going from, say, action unit 12 plus action unit 6 or something. So it's actually breaking it down into the individual muscles. And so then when you go from one expression to the other, it'll be changing the muscles accordingly. So it's kind of exactly what would happen in your face as your brain is changing the signals that it's sending to those muscles. So it's really calculating the nerve signals which are sent to the muscles. That's really what's going on there. So when an actor does change emotional state, then you're measuring exactly that. So you're getting that exact information content, you know. So rather than the actor having their own face driven by these nerve signals, it's a computer generated face. And so what we're trying to do is just calculate those nerve signals, really.
It also seems to me that when you moved to this area, and of course you'll move now in your career from California to New Zealand for Weta, but it seems to me that once you get to an environment like Weta, which is heavy on subsurface scattering and is really dealing with a muscle that moves underneath the skin, in other words, independent, because obviously the initial skin movement is one thing, but if we model to the level of realism that Weta has been doing, you need to have the sea sort of muscles almost underneath the skin, then this approach is perfect for that, because you aren't just moving the topology at the top of the model, you're actually driving a muscle, and that's exactly what you need. You need to drive muscles. Is that correct?
You can do it at multiple levels. Like you can drive an actual muscle, which then drives things on top, or you can drive what would this face look like if this muscle was active, which was kind of what we did for King Kong. So,
right.
You know, King Kong wasn't a muscle model, but it could do all the facts expressions. And they actually kind of, with the Gollum face, they actually had, you know, that was done by building all the different fact shapes. So that, you know, when I started at Weta, they'd already approached faces in a way which was completely amenable to the motion capture stuff that I was calculating. So it was a very easy fit. And Weta has more than any other company, has a real drive for physical realism. You know, a lot of stuff done at Weta is really making creatures which exist in the real physical world. So there's not so much cartoony stuff like Pixar, where, you know, you can have a face stretch in any way that you want. Weta, you want to really feel that there's, you know, it's living flesh and bone, and, you know, it's that's been a lot of the speciality with Weta over the years, and you know, it's really.
Let's discuss a couple of those points in relationship to Kong. I think the first is that Kong was also, because we've been discussing the ability to capture the sort of facial skin stuff, but you also had indirect eye tracking. You actually were trying to, which again is a sort of a high frequency problem, you were trying to get actual subtlety from eye motion on Kong in the capture, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that actually came out because on Kong, the difference in Kong and Monster House was, in Monster House we're really limited to the number of markers on the face we could use. You know, they're about 40 something markers, and they were seen at a, you know, they had to be seen so they're really big markers too, you know, so we couldn't really get a lot of the real fine detail, and it was really big expressions that it could kind of capture. And whereas on Kong, we had one character that we could you know, put like 150 markers on his face or whatever, it ended up being around 100 or something, and then we could really zoom in the cameras and really capture this absolute subtlety of motion. And one of the things that you can do is, if you've got like a couple of markers on the upper eyelid and lower eyelid, is that that's enough to give you the change in contour of the eyelid as the eye looks left and right. And of course, when the eye moves up and down, because you're also solving for which muscle's reactive, you can differentiate eye motion from the contraction of the eyelids due to expression. So you can actually end up solving for eye motion. And the important thing about that is it's completely choreographed with the motion of the character. So if the character is blinking or looking around, you know, those eyes are going to be in the right position. And so that, you know, is very, you know, is always one of the hardest things to do, is to get the eyes right. And, you know, we're actually getting that data out of this through this indirect way. And later for Avatar, it was much easier because we had a helmet camera looking directly at the face, so you could literally see the eyes, and so you know exactly where they are at every frame. But, you know, for King Kong, it was still a cloud of dots. But anyway, that kind of really helped, and also because it's now represented as a fax component, if we needed to change the gaze of the eyes, you know, like say he's looking somewhere slightly different, then you can just scale that whole channel, move that whole channel to change where he's looking without destroying all the saccadic motion.
Well, that's fascinating. And also, I think, from what you said before, Kong was a good candidate because you're retargeting to a non-human face, though, you know, obviously, especially around the nose, there are massive differences in. And yet, there are obviously a lot of similar muscles between a human and a gorilla. But I was interested to read, I think, in one of your earlier papers that Andy, who was doing the actual performance, was also trying to mimic gorilla expressions. And I was wondering, was there a range of things that even an incredibly gifted performer like he couldn't get because a gorilla just does expressions we can't do?
Or? Yeah, there were like some of the lip motions that gorillas can do, you know, there's no way we can do it because they've got much more sort of mobile lips. And, you know, anything which really needed complex gorilla lip motion would have been animated. You know, so we could capture, what we did was kind of set up things where he could do hoots and things like that by making particular shapes with his mouth. And then we could put that in. But if it was something complicated like chewing you can do chewing, but if it's something complicated like, I don't know, something which doesn't fit into FACS framework, because it's still...
vocalization?
I'm sorry?
Like some kind of vocalization?
We did about six key gorilla expressions, which we mixed in. So we did this sort of gorilla facts, but that would cover these major sort of, you know, like silent bared teeth displays and hoots. So we could do those, but there would be ones where, you know, you might have the lip rippling or something like that, which there's just no sort of analogy. And so for those, you know, you can basically use animation to fill in the holes where you can't use the motion capture.
So now you already mentioned that you went on to Avatar next. That was like around 2006. But does a Navi character have a range of expressions that a human can't mimic?
They're pretty much one to one. You know, they like with the Navi characters, they have more, like when they do snarls and things like that, they're more extreme, and you know they'll do things with their ears, you know, like the ears will fold back during different expressions, and those things are all you know, extras, but a lot of it's one to one. I mean, I think James Cameron deliberately wanted the bottom half of the face to be almost identical, so you know a lot of the mouths and chins of these Na'vi characters are really close to the actors, and it's just the upper face which is different, but then again it's still pretty similar. You know, it's just like they've got an extremely wide bridge of their nose.
So you did an initial test in 2006. Was it always the case that you were going to have the helmet cam? Was that a Cameron initiative or was that from your team?
He'd already been playing around with these helmet cameras, and so I think he was quite determined to use them. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, he has direct feedback right from the actor. So he was really looking at using these. So so, you know, Joe Leteri had basically said, you know, James Cameron's looking at this, you know, what can we do for that? And so I then did a test just experimenting to see if I could calculate the facts from a single camera sort of in front of my face, and I decided to drive the Gollum puppet with it, and that kind of ended up working quite well, and so, you know, we ended up going down that path of we knew we could do it at that point from a single camera. And one of the things, of course, is that because you're, you know, even though we've now only got two-dimensional data that we're dealing with, it's an image plane, because the face is a constrained system, there's still enough information in there to know what's happening in three dimensions. So, like, for example, if you pucker your lips, even though the lips are actually coming forward out of the plane, because we're actually calculating what muscles are active, then on three-dimensional model, of course, the lips will come out of the plane, even though the 2D data has been completely flattened. And there would have been no way to do that using traditional motion capture mapping techniques. So breaking it down into these action units was actually essential for the approach that we took on Avatar.
But while that was a gift in terms of having a kind of a fixed camera-to-face relationship, the other curveball that was then thrown at you is that you had to have a real-time solution, not a final solution, but certainly some kind of real-time implementation of what you'd done previously.
Well, because we were using computer vision techniques to track this, Shane Cooper had been working on some neat computer vision techniques tracking the face, and Luca Fascioni had come up with a sort of real time version of the solver. We suddenly thought, wow, we can actually do this in real time now, and have a, you know, direct system, and you know, a live system. And so Joe Leteri kind of kept that under wraps, and James Cameron just happened to be visiting, and you know, lo and behold, look, not only here is a helmet camera working, but it's also working in real time. So, you know, anyway, I think we stayed up till about 2 a.m. trying to get it working the night before that visit. Yeah, because things have a tendency of not working until the very last minute.
It must have been exciting though.
Oh, it was great fun. I mean, we were in the motion capture studio at that time, and it was this really big building, and it had a tin roof in Wellington. It gets really windy, so you know, we'd be there late at night with the wind rattling on this building, and you know, it was really quite fun. And anyway, when James Cameron came in, we had Shane Rangi, the sort of mocap performer here, and we had him driving a model of Andy Serkis. So then James Cameron would come in, and he could look through a virtual camera, and he could see this virtual Andy Serkis performing and doing facial expressions, even though it was Shane Rangi. And so, you know, I think that was one of the things which, you know, helped sell what we were doing.
Well, yeah, and obviously over the next few years, as the film got completed, there must have been more improvements and refinements, because this obviously is, you know, and rightly so, that sort of the pinnacle of this kind of performance system. Were there many innovations that came through during production, or did you have to sort of bed it down?
Oh, there's lots of things ongoing. Ian Matthews had written some really robust eye tracking software, which actually ended up helping a lot, because you know, you get the eyes exactly right, because the data that we were dealing with was actually, when we started getting the real production data, it was very, very noisy in terms of the actors running. So you'd have the camera kind of bouncing around, and so dealing with this real data actually ended up being quite a big deal. And Dejan Momosilovic was the motion capture supervisor there. He sort of came up with some neat ideas to kind of stabilize the helmet camera. So we sort of implemented that into the real time solver, and he'd also got things set up in Maya so that we could have a Maya control system driving the character going into Filmbox. So we'd kind of have like this kind of pipeline system that that Luke had kind of engineered, which would feed into Filmbox, so you could see the facial expression done live on the character, on the Filmbox character, even though the body was coming from Giant. You know, we were using our own system to do the face, but then we had a way of like tweaking it on the fly in Maya. So that was really quite neat. And this was the real time system. But what we decided to do is we decided to do two tracks. So we had a real-time system, which was very rough and ready, and then we had a very accurate offline system. So, the neat thing is, because we're actually getting this video data and recording it, like later on, we for the actual shots, we'll go and process that, you know, at a sub-pixel level for the tracking. And John Lewis had written some software which would really help in sort of automatically calculating where these markers were and tracking them across the frames. And so we had a bunch of really good computer vision and tracking software which would handle a lot of this tracking very accurately. And then we'd get the data, and then we had a motion editing team that Diane was supervising, who would then go in and really tune the actual motion capture solver to exactly hit the performance. And, then that result would get sent to animation, and they would do any other tweaks which they had to do. And you know, then you'd get the final product. But we had you know, quite a well-oiled pipeline for that.
Can I ask you some general principle questions, not specifically aimed at Avatar, but obviously the logic behind it? I mean, let's take Sam Worthington. He's obviously a fairly buffed, fairly young, skin's quite taut on the musculature. But if you had an older actor, then there'd be actual skin movement over the muscles that wasn't driven by performance, but was driven by head inertia. And if you're, I guess, sampling points still off the surface, then you're going to... Is that just come through as erroneous data, or has that come through as something that gets filtered?
No, you can actually project that out. So what you can do is, like you say, if this motion is caused by gravity, then we can add that into the solver and then just throw it away, because it'll solve out data onto that, and then it's basically projected out from the solution. So, you know, that's the way that we handle, that type of motion.
I mean, if you're only observing the skin surface, how many points is sort of enough in a, you know, good production sense?
Well, in Avatar, we're probably using around 40-something points, I think, and you can do less. I mean, there's multiple sort of criteria here. Part of it's robustness, and the reason like the Avatar setup was like it was because we were using computer vision, like markerless tracking for the eyes, and then we were using marker tracking for the face. So, and the reason for that choice, because we could have gone markerless tracking for the whole thing, but that's not very robust or super accurate when you've got featureless areas. Like, you might have the cheek skin moving, and if it's like, you know, a piece of pink flesh which looks the same in one frame as it does in the other, you're not quite sure whether it's moved unless you've got, you know, like you can see the pores moving, you know, like it could be quite smooth. Whereas in some parts of the face, like the corner of the mouth, you know, it's really obvious where that's moving. So you can apply markerless tracking to that area. And the eyes have got lots of contrast and lots of information in them, so you can use markerless tracking there. But for the rest of the face, to be certain that we were getting accurate tracking of the skin motion, you know, I wanted us to use markers for those areas, so that we kind of had this fallback thing and a very robust way of tracking that information. And because the video footage that we're getting wasn't the greatest, you know, the cameras were, you know, 640 by 480 resolution, and all kinds of things could happen. The actors could spit on them. You know, they'd get knocked out of focus. There was all kinds of things, but we're still able to basically see the vital information. And
I mean, in an ideal world, how much of an actor's facial performance would you capture, and how? I mean, not criticizing anything in the past, but just like if you had a perfect setup, how high res would you want that camera to be? How much would you want to capture?
I think there's really, it comes down to getting these really subtle, the most critical stuff is the eye and the mouth, and you're really trying to capture that in as much detail as you can. And so if you've got image-based tracking for those things, that's actually great, because you can really see every pixel, and that's a hell of a lot of information. And then for the other areas, you just need to get enough information to really work out which muscles are active, because if you're driving a different character. However, if you're doing like a digital double, an exact match, then you may well want to capture all the tiny changes. You know, you might do something like, you know, the UCAP system that they did in The Matrix or something like that, where you're really literally capturing the geometry and the video and just reprojecting it later on. So it kind of depends what you're trying to achieve.
Because in terms of the brain's physiology for processing faces, there's actually discrete parts of the brain that process eyes and another discrete part that processes mouths and faces. And so, in fact, they don't even actually necessarily in your own brain talk to each other, which is why, you know, you can do sort of all sorts of clever tricks in Photoshop sometimes. But we have, like, highly articulated brain functions for just dealing with eye processing from a physiologic point. Well, do you take any of that into account?
That's an area which is of large interest to me. I'm very interested in, you know, the what's going on to create those signals. And it turns out that you can actually have you can have the conscious part of visual processing in your brain damaged, but your eyes will still track an object. So you can have somebody who's almost clinically dead lying in a room, but they will watch you walk around the room. And so it's really fascinating stuff. And there's been, you know, and the control system for the face has got, there's different pathways. There's actually a sort of like a limbic system type pathway, which goes to the facial muscles, and also there's a cognitive aspect to it. So you can, part of the capturing what's so wonderful about what's going on in a person's face is that there's things which they're deliberately controlling, and then there's things which the emotional part of their brain is just controlling whether they like it or not, and they're not even necessarily conscious of it. And
Mark, remind me never to get drunk at a dinner party opposite you at the dinner table. I think so.
you just have to make sure that I was in the same state, right? That's sort of what's going on. You know, it's interesting with children too. You have a child when they're young, they have emotional control over their face, but they don't have cognitive control yet. In other words, they can't like if they're feeling sad, they will just show a cry. They can't mask that with a smile. You know, later on as adults, we deliberately, you know, in social situations, we'll put on a big smile to kind of cover up, you know, what you might be really feeling underneath. But, you know, if you look closely, you know, like the work that Paul Ekman's done is that you can actually work out what's really going on, because there's certain telltale muscle actions. And that's a lot of fun, and I think, you know, when you've got a complex computer-generated character, you've got to be able to capture that interplay. So you need enough detail to really capture the interplay of what's going on. And like you said before, with the eyes being a separate system, you actually have there's a lot of really lower level brain control over how the eyes move, and so. You'll have things like the vestibular ocular reflex, which is if you turn your head, your eyes will automatically saccade in order to track certain objects. They'll move in a particular way, whereas if you're actually looking and tracking at an object, the eyes will move in a different path. Now, those are things which are unrelated to the emotion that you might be feeling at the time. However, they're critical for the realistic appearance of the behavior of the character. So those are things you have to pay attention to. You know, you've got to get that stuff right, because if you have a character running and the eyes aren't saccading properly, we will notice it. It'll just look dead for some reason, even though it might not be related to the actor's expression. It will somehow appear dead. And, you know, that's one of my key interests is like, exactly what does it take to give the illusion of life? You know, not just the illusion of life in a Disney sense, but the illusion of that's an actual real consciousness there in front of you, because that's really the ultimate goal with, you know, these computer generated characters.
Yeah, what would make you think that the face I'm looking at is itself thinking?
Yes, and it's like, even if it's not thinking, is it alive? You know, like,
right?
Yeah, you know, it's those little tiny things, and then so it's all these layers of, like, you know, your autonomous nervous system, memories coming into your brain, which affects the eye motion. It might be how you're moving, which can affect the eye motion. You've got all these different things going on, and you know, what I'd really like to do is to be able to break things down on that level, because, you know, some of the work that we're doing at Life Effects was you know, making this stuff interactive and really having to look into, you know, how can you model this so it's a controllable thing? And, you know, you do it for visual effects, but it'd be really interesting to look at this on a live character, you know, a live computer generated character which is almost present with you. That's something I'm definitely have an interest in.
Now, I want to ask you something, because we've talked about the sampling and the process of going to the fax space, but at the other end, when are blend shapes enough for facial animation? I mean, when do you actually need to be doing physical simulation for things such as, like, the properties of skin under gravity, etc.?
It really comes down to effort. You know, you can use any system that you want to achieve something. Like, you could even build, you know, a face full of, you know, cleverly placed joints and make that work. Or you can use blend shapes, or you can do a muscle system. So you really, it kind of comes down to what's the most efficient way to do it, and also, you know, down to the artist's skill and preference, in a way. I've got sort of particular view on that. I can't really go into, you know, what I'm
sure
sort of, you know.
Well, then let me ask you a different question, because completely tangential to that, which is that, obviously, and congratulations, you're receiving another SciTech award this time for this work in the development and implementation of this. But in your career, you've worked with terrific researchers that have worked inside facilities like WETA, but also, as we mentioned earlier, you've worked with people that are not inside facilities. I wonder if you could just tell me your view, I guess, on the role of academia versus the VFX industry when it comes to research and advance in the art, and how that figures in, because you have contributed a lot to SIDGRAPH over the years.
Yeah, this is one of the things which I absolutely love about my job, is the people that I've worked with. You know, the caliber of the people, and in all the different fields, from... And it's nice, sort of like, seeing some of this work converge. Peter Hunter, for example, is my ex-PhD supervisor. You know, he's been running the World Physiome Project, which is a complete sort of computational modeling of the human body, and, you know, very, very detailed work down to even, you know, the cellular level, looking at the mathematics at that level and kind of scaling it up. And so working with him, and then with his brother Ian Hunter, who's doing all kinds of amazing things, I've spoken to primatologists. When I was researching stuff for King Kong, I've been speaking to Paul Ekman. I've met these sort of top scientists and psychologists and whatever in all these different fields, and then also dealing with the actors and hearing their perspective on you know what they're trying to achieve and how they're getting across things has been, you know, this incredible sampling of all these different areas of science and arts, you know, like seeing the, you know, the directors direct things in their own particular styles, and it's the artists, you know, here at Weir are just incredible. I mean, it's working with like the digital versions, digital incarnations of Michelangelo. You know, it's really fantastic. I mean, so in that area, you know, it's really so inspiring. You know, it's really like firing off, you know, all my synapses, you know, one way or the other through all these different people. And it's kind of like, you know, I'm trying to, you know, take in as much of those things and combine as much of those influences as possible to, you know, because each sort of discipline has its own logics and ways of seeing information and things, and that's what I really like, is, you know, everybody's approaching something from a different point of view, and it's kind of like a hologram. You know, the more pieces of that, more fragments of that hologram that you have, the closer you get to representing the truth of the object that you're looking at, and you know, it tells you what to pay attention to. Like, you know, Paul Ekman, for example, by really paying attention to what is a facial expression, is it universal, you know, what are the small components of it, how does that work, it told us that we needed to focus on these elements. You know, working with Peter Hunter was like, okay, it really says, you know, we've really got to pay attention to what's going on physiologically. And, you know, Joe Lettieri's fantastic in as a visual effects supervisor, because he's got a very broad range of knowledge and interest, and you know, he's able to sort of keep up on any level, and that's just fantastic. And he's also you know, very forward thinking in that way and wanting to progress art as well as science. So I think you know, the environment's been really excellent.
Yeah, Joe sort of set the tone that has been very collaborative and very creative, though of course also technically, you know, robust. I guess this is a great note to finish on, because I do think that obviously it's a collaborative effort, filmmaking. It is a process of working together, but also it's you know, a process that evolves, and the work of one project builds on the work of another, and so it goes back. So I can't thank you enough for sharing this walk down the evolution of the work that you've been doing in biomechanical simulation of the face with us. We really appreciate it a lot. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks to Mike and to Mark, and I hope you enjoyed that series of the tech behind the films. We really enjoyed doing that kind of digging into that kind of tech talk, and Mike, I know, had a good time doing this series, and like I said earlier, the response was really good. Next week, we're going to shift a little bit from the technical side to an artistic side with a conversation with Sean Tan, co-director of the Oscar-nominated short film The Lost Thing. It's a short film that took years to complete, all animated, and I think you'll enjoy the conversation about that. So that'll do it for this FX podcast. For my partners, John Montgomery and Mike Seymour, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.